actually two speakers this morning. We have Steve Harrell and Jeff Morgan. And Steve is a professor in anthropology and adjunct professor of Chinese. And he's an anthropologist of China and Taiwan and has taught at the University of Washington since 1974. And his first research in Taiwan was in 1972 and 73. And looking at individual differences in folk religion. In the 1980s, he turned his attention to Sichuan, where he became interested in ethnicity and ethnic relations. And he has established in 2000 the Yangon Primary School, and now heads the UW Worldwide Program, exchanging undergraduates with Sichuan University, involving many of them in ecological field work and community service in the Yangzhuang School. And he plans to devote the rest of his professional career to international scholarly and educational exchange and to research human-environment interactions in the US, China, and Taiwan. Jeff is a civil and environmental engineering and international studies student who is focusing on developing development through engineering-related projects. And he spent some time in China, which we'll hear about here, developmental research on NGO water projects in rural China. And at the end of 2008, he helped rebuild a project and extended it so it would supply more water and reach more people. So the presentation this morning is entitled Designing and Building a Practical Household Water Supply in the Mountains of Southwest China. So, Steve and Jeff.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that very kind introduction. Can everybody hear in the back? Okay, good. I hate microphones because I always get tangled up in a cord and do pratfalls and things like that. So we want to talk about the practicalities of building a water project. And I know how to work my computer. All right, because there's a lot of talk and a lot of truth behind the talk that building water projects, which is always considered to be one of the best things that can be done for the health of people in poor countries. And I don't like to use euphemisms like third world countries or developing countries or something like that. What we're talking about is poor countries. That one of the best things that can be done for people in these places in terms of health is to build access to water, and also in terms of convenience. Because it's not just a matter of health, it's also a matter of 1 or 2 hours a day lugging water from some place, which is very heavy. So water systems are a very important thing if they work. However, they don't always work. Sometimes, as you can see here, they work very nicely. People have a nice spigot in their house. They can get buckets of water out of this. They can use it for cooking. They can use it for washing, cleaning, other things. And sometimes they fail, and people are consigned to or condemned to taking water out of dirty pools with cows pooping in them and pigs rolling in them and mud and sediment and other kinds of awful things all through the water, even though in this place there in fact was a water system that was built. So what we're interested in looking at is what in fact are the factors in success and failure of building small-scale water systems, household water systems in poor communities. And what we're going to do today is to take a case study from Southwest China to look at these different factors. So the first thing is I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce the background of the community and the conditions under which we worked. And then Jeff is going to take over and talk about the specific project, how it was built, what the problems were, some of the ways in which the problems were overcome, we hope. And then we'll draw some general conclusions coming back to these factors in the success or failure of local water projects. So where are we? We are in Sichuan. And if you don't know where Sichuan is, shame on you, because it's got more people than any country in Europe. And if you don't know where Sichuan is, you shouldn't know where France is either. Sichuan is a bigger and more important place. But we're in Sichuan, and the Sichuan Basin is there in the middle where all the... Sichuan Basin is here in the middle. And the southern part of Sichuan is very mountainous. And we're working right here where this red dot is.
a day and a night and a day's train and bus ride from the capital city of Chengdu here in these mountains. The place where we're working, the elevation is about 2,500 meters. If you don't know how much that is in feet, tough. This is science class. The road time to the nearest city is about 5 hours. To the nearest actual city, there's some towns that are closer. And the topography can best be described in technical terms as vertical. Now, in this area where we're working, the Baidu Valley, Google Maps, by the way, is wonderful. You know, you can pull this off and you can get a topo map of wherever you are working. And we're working in an area that has four villages, Yangquan, Pianshui, Gango, and Zhuchang. These two villages have about 400 people each. These two villages have about 100 people each. And it's a quite a varied topography, as you can see here. I won't spend a whole lot of time talking about this. I'm just trying to give you a brief background. The climate, obviously, is very important for water projects and for success or failure. What we really want to look at so much is not... This is the closest available climate diagram. This is about 1,000 meters lower down. So you have to take this temperature thing and move it down about 10 degrees. But the Niederschlag, the rainfall, is, you can see, it goes up in June through September is a great majority of the rainfall. It drops off quickly in October, November, and from December through March or April, there's very little rainfall. This has a huge impact on what you need to do to build a successful water project. The people who live there, this thing is going on its own. The people who live there belong to the Nosu ethnic group. They're part of what the Chinese call the Yi nationality. They mostly live in this Liangshan region where we are. They used to be called the Independent Lolo. There's a wonderful book by Edgar Snow called Red Star Over China, classic account of the Chinese Revolution. It talks about the fierce independent Lolo who swear blood oaths. These are them. They're organized into a clan society, a patriclan organization, stratified by castes. They have a Tibeto-Burman language with a syllabary script, of which you can see an example right there. In this area, their subsistence is they have a variety of traditional subsistence crops, which don't show up very well in this light, but at least you can see the lettering. They raise a variety of livestock. In different environments, and in the high environment, this includes yaks up in the high pastures, which are around 3,300 meters and above. And they deal with forest products as a very important part of their livelihood. That is to say, bamboo, firewood is the most important thing. It's the only source of fuel that people have. And we have an expert on that here in the second row here. Also get foods and medicines and a limited amount of building and construction materials from the forest. They're very aware in terms of traditional knowledge about the importance of water to the environment. And Nosu people have a series of what they call rubs. It's a very difficult language to pronounce for English speakers. Rubs is a kind of a traditional saying. It can be one line, it can be up to four lines, but it forms a kind of a metaphor between something and something else. It teaches lessons. And so when you say, don't ruin the source of your own water, it means literally don't ruin the source of your own water. But it also means don't wreck the source of anything you need. You know, if you have somebody who's always lending you money, be nice to them. Right? Because otherwise you're ruining the source of your own water. So there's a metaphorical association back and forth between things like the natural environment and the social environment. If we look at another one, this is a really interesting one. The mother's brother gives to the father, and the flow of water is maintained. When I first heard that, I thought, well, what's he talking about? Explain, please. Right? But what it means is the gift of the wife giving affines, the people who give a bride, is like the gift of flowing water. Now, what does that mean? Well, what it means is this. These are the patriclan organization. The clan has to continue its paternal line of descent in order to survive. It has to produce sons. How does the clan produce sons?
It can't produce sons on its own, right? It has to bring in a mother. It has to bring in a woman to bear children for that clan. And so standing next to the father who continues the clan is his wife's brother, who has given the wife so that the clan can continue its existence, so it can continue reproducing. The same thing happens with a stream. The stream is a source of, not of reproduction, but the stream is a source of production. You need water for drinking, you need water for crops, you need water to feed the animals, you need water for washing. Water is a crucial resource. And just like the clan, which can't reproduce itself, water will get fouled, will get messed up, unless it has trees next to it. And so the tree standing by the water, which prevents erosion, which lessens runoff, and which decreases the sediment load, is just like the clan standing next to you. The tree allows you to reproduce your material resources next to the water, and the mother's brother standing beside the father allows you to reproduce your human resources. So there's a kind of traditional knowledge here that's very aware of environmental relations and of the connections and the similarities between the natural world and the human world. Okay, let's go to our village for a minute, and we can't spend too much time on this, but we have two villages, cheek by jowl, about 5-minute walk from one to another, but they're very different social structure. In the Yangzhen village, which you have there to the left, there's one dominant clan called the Ngubu clan, and the several clans that are married into it, and the former serfs and slaves who were liberated in 1957, but who are still living there, most of them in that same community. So it's a fairly tight-knit community with everybody related to each other through traditional obligations. Kenshui, on the other hand, was mostly people who may have been of okay status, but most and others who were definitely serfs and slaves previously, but they were brought from all over. So there's no coherence. There's a whole lot of different rival, different castes, different clans, and there's never been they've never had a kind of political or social coherence in the way that Yangzhen village has had. And there's very little relationship between the two villages, even though, as I say, you can walk from 5 minutes, and if you shout loud, you can hear one from the other. Okay, some of the background of what we've done before. Bob mentioned this in his introduction. We got together a bunch of local and foreign people to build a primary school in the village, which has been the basis of a lot of other activities that we've had. We've done a lot of previous research on a whole lot of different topics. And my apologies here for Sarah for not including indoor air quality. But that's an indoor air quality is another thing that we've been doing. Sarah's been doing research on here. But we have had very interdisciplinary involvement in both the human sciences and the biophysical sciences in this area since about 1999. I've been going even longer than that. I've been going since 1993, but the first one I went was mostly just anthropology. And we've also had some earlier development initiatives. We have, for one thing, of course, we have the water projects. I guess this is one of the, yeah. We have the first water project, and Jeff's going to talk about this in more detail. I'm going to hand off to him in just a minute. A group called the Ecologie Sans Frontières. Everything is sans frontières these days, right? Including engineers. They built some water projects, which Jeff will talk about in more detail. I would say they were all partial successes and partial failures. None completely flopped. They're all still producing water for some people in some places at some time. So you can't consider them total failures. On the other hand, none of them is doing exactly what it was designed to do, so you can't consider it a total success. There was also a sheep development project, which I have to say that I opposed from the start because I didn't think there was ecologically room for any more sheep. But the people said, oh, no, we can grow fodder to feed the sheep and it won't put pressure on the pastures. And in fact, it's increased sheep by a little bit, but it's been kind of fuzzy. Another thing was greenhouses. Beautiful greenhouses, built for not too much money, hoping to sell vegetables to the local market. But then they forgot that it's windy in the wintertime, and the greenhouses blew over. So the greenhouses were built in 2007, and there's no trace of them today.
So what I'm setting out to do here with the background then is to tell you that this is not a place where we went in cold. This is a place where lots of us have done research, have done community development, have done schooling projects of various sorts for a whole decade before this project came up. And this has, I think, an important impact on the lesson that we want to talk about when we talk about success and failure of water projects. Because most water projects, in fact, the organization goes in cold. They go into a place and they got 2 weeks and they're going to build it something. They don't know who's going to use it. They don't know what the politics are and so forth. But we didn't go in cold, and still we had problems. So with that introduction, I'm going to turn this over to Jeff.
Hello, everyone. As I said before, I'm Jeff Morgan. I'm a fourth-year student at UW studying civil and environmental engineering and international studies focusing on development. I was combining the two disciplines so that I can hopefully analyze NGO water projects or other development projects. All right. Well, as been introduced earlier, Professor Harrell also leads the UW Worldwide Sichuan UW Exchange. And on 2000-2008 academic year, I went on the study abroad. And as part of the program, we were required to do an independent research project. And I decided to do my research project on the previous NGO water projects that had been in the village or in the villages surrounding Yangzhen, and where Professor Harrell had been doing so much of his work. A quick overview of my research. I made 5 trips to the village, total of 6 weeks in the field. I was able to analyze a total of 4 different NGO water projects. And last summer, as a culmination to my project, I was able to rebuild and extend a project above the Liudui, which is the 6th team above Yangzhen Village, and then increase water flow and, to 6 more households as well. The first project that I was able to look at was the school well, which was built in alongside the school in 2000. However, some of the problems with the well is that during the dry season, in the winter months, the well would dry up, and the villagers were then forced to go to the river. However, in 2008, the teachers at the school decided that they wanted to discontinue using the well because they thought the water in the well didn't taste very good, and decided that it was just better to use the pumping system that had been previously in the well and place it in the river. So they're just continuously pumping water out of the river. The next project I looked at was another well. This well was in Pianshui. This was built by the Hydrologists Without Borders. It also had the same problem of drying up for 3 months of the year during the winter months. However, I didn't do much work on looking at how to extend these projects because it would require finding a lower water table and to drill deeper, which were resources that I did not have available to me. So I just was able to analyze them from a sociologist's point of view to see how they were affecting the villagers and how they were being used. The next project that I was able to look at was the Pianshui pipeline, which was built in 2005, again by the Hydrologists Without Borders. Where'd the remote go? There it is. Laser. Yeah, I found it. All right. The origins of the project are a pipe that's kind of going off the picture here. It's just basically an open pipe placed in the middle of a stream. Nothing on the end of it to try and filter any particles going through. Then goes down to this concrete reservoir before then going down to the village. In the village, it originally had 11 public faucets. However, when we arrived in 2007, only 8 of them were continuing to work. After talking with the villagers, they said that there was not enough water during the dry season, and if we could, they would want us to try and build upon this project, make it so that it had more water and reached more people. However, when I came back in October, one of my plans was to try and reconnect those remaining 3 faucets that had discontinued working. My TA and I, we started digging up the ground where the one end of the pipe was. We could see it was still sticking out of the ground. Started digging down, looking for the other side of it. Kept digging and started getting really puzzled because it wasn't there anymore. And started looking around and realized that the remaining three faucets that had been there 2 months prior were no longer there. After talking with some of the villagers, we found out what happened is that a type of feud had almost been created over this project. During the opening slide where you saw the pictures of the women having to collect water out of the muddy pools is the result of the NGO had not done enough research into looking at the social dynamics of the village and ended up putting a member of the lower clan in control of the project, thus making the upper clan rather angry and kind of taking control of the project. They cut off the pipe at that point there and let the water continue to flow out onto the street for about 3 weeks, saturating it. Then pulled up the pipeline and the faucets and put them in their own homes. So instead of having public faucets along the main roadway of the village, they were able to put them in their own homes, thus taking advantage of the lower clan. Thus, also after the water from spilling out of the road, making it super saturated, they filled in the roadway with rocks to make it passable, which would make any further development in trying to put more pipe in very, very difficult. And after analyzing these social dynamics and speaking with the members of the lower clan, they decided that it would not be a very good idea for us to try and rebuild the project because they thought that the upper clan would just try and take advantage of it again. The next project that I was able to look at was the project above Leo Dwe, which was the first project in the area for them. What the project comprised of were two little reservoirs like that placed here and here, which basically were caps on top of springs where water was bubbling out of the ground. So they collected it there. The source, the two reservoirs, then came to this metal collecting basin, which functioned as a kind of filter. It allowed sediment to settle on the bottom, those nice thick layered, and then from there continued down to the concrete reservoir. Down was placed directly above the school. This project was built in July of 2007, so it was built a month before my first trip out there. It was built by another NGO group called Friends of Yongjun, and it supplied 30 homes originally, and then in December of 2007, the Yongjun Primary School, which had been introduced earlier, was connected to it. However, along with all the other projects in the area, they had come into problems during the winter months when there was not enough water. And luckily, this project, in order to try and utilize the water that was there, had the ability of shutting off the water in different areas of the village. So the area of the village that was furthest away from the river was still able to receive at least a small portion of water. And then the villagers that were close to the river just had to go to the river and use buckets and haul it out. So then in January 2008, the villagers ended up trying to take it upon themselves to try and improve this project. They saw a potential to get more water, and so that they would have everyone on the project would be able to have it year-round. However, when they tried digging the reservoirs deeper and making them larger, they didn't quite know what they were doing, and instead of improving the project, they ended up damaging it to the point of where it barely functioned. So then my idea of a project was born to rebuild and improve those two existing reservoirs and then go up a side valley above the even above those two dams. I found two more places for reservoirs, built two new ones, and then connected the two new ones to the existing pipeline and then added six more homes to the project. So just go through a couple phases of the project. This is the location that I found. I placed a reservoir there and right where the two men are standing. But in order to fulfill my idea, I had to try and come up with funding in order to purchase all of my materials. I was able to apply through the Riser Foundation and was given a grant And for $500 of the grant was used to buy all of these materials. It's amazing how much you can buy with only $500. And as you can see here in the picture, the children were very excited to get the materials and had a lot of fun. I don't know if you can really see it in that picture. It's kind of dark, but they're playing in the big circles of tubing, kind of playing hide and seek. I don't know if you were little, playing in the stacks of tires. I know I did. One of the difficulties of building the project, though, is that you're in the middle of the mountains in rural China. There's not a Home Depot or a Lowe's right around the corner. So the closest available town is called Yanyuan, which is about 3 hours away and over rough terrain. And I went there and was able to procure all my items and then hire a truck and haul it out to where the school was. But from there, we still had to get the supplies up the half-an-hour trail to where the project site was. To do this, I was able to enlist a member from each one of the village households to be part of my construction team, and they helped carry them up to the construction site. First started off digging down to bedrock so that I had a solid foundation for the project, and this way, unlike the previous project, the water was going through the soil and just passing underneath the reservoir. This way, if we were able to create more of a solid dam sitting on bedrock, the water would not be able to flow underneath and escape, and making it more efficient. Then I also designed the dams to be made out of concrete so that they're more permanent and there's a less chance of the villagers then going back and trying to modify them themselves. One of the other difficulties that we had was, since it was in a valley further up the mountain range, we had to cross a 40-meter gap between the two valleys to connect it to the project, and was able to hang the pipe using a series of wires and linkages to get it across, and it actually went up much easier than I had originally foreseen. I was really happy about that. There's a few finalized pictures of the completed reservoirs. The one on the left is the one that had been rebuilt, and the one on the right is one that was built in the new valley. Sorry if I'm going kind of quick. If you guys have any questions on these things later, please let me know. Then continued to lay a new pipeline through the village, had to destroy a few walls, and we put five new faucets together in six homes. The project ended up being very successful. I was able to increase the water supply by over three times what the original project had back after its completion. And to my knowledge, it's still working very well today. So now, going back to some of those factors that Professor Harrell had mentioned earlier on in the lecture, many times experts in different fields will think of local knowledge as anecdotal and methodically questionable. However, more and more NGOs are starting to realize the usefulness and necessity of listening to local knowledge of water resources, because the knowledge is specific to that location. The observations are based on hands-on experience, and the data is generated by resource users, which is all things you want when trying to find locations for your project. For instance, in southwestern China, many NGOs don't have the luxury of what I had, of being able to go back throughout the year and seeing what the climate was like. Two of these pictures were taken during the winter. As you can see, it's very, very dry. Most of the streams dry up where the products were functioning no longer. And it's very crucial that you work with the villagers to find those resources, because they're year-round, and they are still having to collect water. So they're the ones that you can rely on to make sure your project is running year-round. Also, many times NGOs will try and rely on foreign technology, such as water filters or chemicals, to try and treat the water. However, historical trends have shown that these end up making more problems than helping the villagers. These technologies are many times unsustainable unless there's a well-established framework for maintenance. If a NGO comes in with a knowing elapsed time between necessary repairs in their project, It'd be fine. For example, when I was looking in the large concrete reservoir above Pianshui, I found a bag that had looked to be used to slowly put iodine into the water to try and treat it. However, that iodine had run out years before. It was no longer functioning or doing what it had originally intended. So if the NGO had been able to keep coming back every year whenever that bag was thought to run out and put a new iodine bag in, that would have been fine. But they just kind of left, and when the iodine ran out, there was nothing the villagers could do. So looking at the sustainability of a technology, you have to make sure that it has the component parts or the infrastructure to get those parts and the technical know-how in order to fix it. For example, I mean, how many of you have used a Brita filter before? Yeah, pretty much everyone. You know where to get it. They're easy to find. Many of us take that for granted. It's seen here in the picture on the right. Well, I guess you guys can't see that. It's just a small little marketplace outside the village, and you find very rudimentary things. There's just no way you're going to find any type of carbon or microfilter anywhere, and there's really no resource for them to get it. So when you're taking this into account, if you're going to put a microfilter in your project, if it gets clogged, let's say by the torrential downpour and there's a lot of sediment in your project, the microfilter will get clogged and then essentially renders the project useless unless they just take the filter out and then run the project without being filtered at all, thus going back to possibly hazards of getting polluted water. As seen before, when NGOs do not look closely enough at the social and cultural factors of a project, many times you can create conflict among the villagers. As seen with the Pianshui example, the villagers were then cut off from the project and forced to drink out of the muddy pools. If the NGO had possibly taken a little more time and spoken with the villagers, tried to find out a little bit more about the social dynamics, they may not have put a member of the lower clan in control of the project, or they may also have tried to register the project with the local government so that it'd be a major deterrent to the clan ever trying to modify it or to harm the project in any way. Also, many times a perfectly clean running water project can fail due to the people not knowing how to utilize the benefits of this project, and those benefits can be nullified by poor hygiene and sanitation practices, such as open defecation, personal household washing not increasing, and the water not being protected from contamination at home. An example of this, and going to talk, trying to teach the villagers about where the source of contamination can come from, one of my trips looking up to the source of the Pianshui project, I found a pig wallow right here that was then draining into the creek, and right at the bottom here, right here, is where the inlet, well, under that rock, is where the in-pipe is. So all this muddy water that had been going for the pig's bath is going right into the drinking water going down to the village. I mean, that water was teeming with coliform bacteria and making people sick. I'm sure you and I, just looking at that water, wouldn't want to come anywhere near it. And it just shows that without education, people don't know if they're doing anything wrong. So what should NGO do then is try and orchestrate a network of volunteers, usually women, because they're the ones who have the closest association with the family health practices, and also they're the ones that tend to be more closely associated and working with the water systems. But to teach them about transmission of disease, the importance of personal hygiene, and the usefulness of a good water supply, and if people do get dehydrated, what to do about it. Then kind of going off the last slide, why are we thinking about utilizing women's roles? Well, and trying to get them more involved in a water system, it's mainly because try and create it from the beginning to end. Women in this village are particularly the ones who are collecting water. So if you put them in charge of maintaining a system, If they're the ones collecting the water, they'd be more likely to try and make sure that the system is maintained and functioning properly. If they're the ones getting it, they're also the ones who will be storing the water and determining how it is used for the family's health. However, many times NGOs are faced with a numbers game. They have to try and build a certain number of projects every year, and it takes a lot of time to sit down and try and think about all these different factors. It takes a lot of time to look into the social dynamics of a village and to find out where the water is, and the quality of the water. So many times they may end up making a decision to build as many projects as they can. I mean, as Steve said before, none of these projects have failed completely. They just have failed in a sense that they're not working to their original intent, to their original design. So they build a high number of projects that have a lower success rate, or a small number of projects that have a higher success rate. That's kind of the dilemma that the NGOs are facing with regards to water projects. Any questions?
Okay. Is the provincial or local government involved in building or maintaining?
Can you repeat the question?
Okay. The question was the provincial government involved in maintaining the water projects at all? No, they're not. These are pretty much up to the villagers to take care of themselves.
Provincial government, you have to understand that Sichuan is, for the province, 90 million people. So it would be like, you know, a bureaucrat from the ministry in Paris going to some little mountain village in the Pyrenees and taking account of it. The part of the problem, too, with Pianshui is that the party secretary is a member of the clan who usurped the project for their own use. So in other words, the government wouldn't have been a defense against that, because the local representative of the government was basically one of the perpetrators of the injustice. So that, yeah, got real difficult.
The question was, how did we communicate with the villagers? Most of the villagers there speak Mandarin or Sichuanese, which while I was in China, I was studying Mandarin intensively and was able to pick up Sichuanese because I lived with a Sichuanese family. So I was able to communicate with them. You're in the back, Pink? Yes.
Say the question. I can hear it.
The question was, how were the villagers perceiving the foreigners coming into the village and the different perceptions, correct? And the foreigners coming in to help and the different opinions of that.
Depends on your attitude. And this is not any kind of thing that can be generalized. But Nosu people have a strong sense of loyalty and obligation. And so they feel that they're wronged. And they also have a great sense of cultural and what they would describe as racial pride. And particularly if Chinese come in and act haughty, that brings in a very negative kind of a reaction. Americans have a little bit more leeway because they don't have a history of conflict with Nosu. But nevertheless, it depends a lot on attitude, and it also has something to do with the social structure, because we got involved with these communities through the dominant clan in Yangchen, the Ngubu clan. And one of the members of the Ngubu clan is a co-author of two books with me and a co-curator of an exhibit at the Burke Museum a few years ago. And it was his idea to build the school. And so his clan, particularly his branch of his clan, is very positive toward everything. But they have their traditional rivalries with other people. And so it's not just the villagers as one group of people who are, you know, thinking about the foreigners as one group. There are different kinds of foreigners. Chinese are one kind of, they're not foreigners, one kind of outsiders. Americans are another kind of outsiders. and Gubu are one kind of insider. People who are in a rival clan are another kind of insider. And so you can't make a generalization. However, the relationships in general are very good. You know, we have a good time. And I think most of those people have a good time. Susan.
You talked about the problem with NGOs not having long-term contact. Do you guys have a long-term plan for checking on whether these systems continue to work for the next 5 years, 10 years?
Yes, I'm hoping to go back there next year to check up on the project and continue doing some more of my research to see how it has continued to function and what the effects have been. But also, I mean, Steve's study abroad program tends to have students that go back there every year. Currently, the program right now has one girl who goes back there multiple times a year, and she can check up on it for me, make sure it's working all right.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, because the first two projects were started by a group of French Jesuits from Taiwan. And this is an international deal here. And they hired the Hydrologists Without Borders, the Hydrologie Sans Frontières, to do their projects for them. And then they felt that they hadn't been ideal and the relations hadn't been ideal. So the third project, the one that was the first Liu Dui project, the one that Jeff improved on, was actually the Jesuits just did it on their own. They started to learn enough of this, and they brought in some local people who knew some basic engineering and did that on their own. And I think they did a better job than the professional hydrologists, although not as good as Jeff did. So it's this kind of a kind of continuing relay sort of relationship. Another.
What sort of education are you doing in school here with respect to the project?
With the project? I had a discussion with some of the teachers to try and further the children's understanding of washing at home so that they could then take the knowledge about good hygiene and bring it back to their own households and teach it then to their parents. So kind of try to create a network through the school that's already been established and then work its way out to the households in the community.
Do you have a designated person who looks after these systems?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, the thing about washing is interesting because this is not a remote area. I mean, yeah, it's 5 hours to the nearest city in vertical terrain, but there are lots of places in Liangshan that are way harder to get to than this. And in those areas, people don't wash. You know, it just hadn't been a thing. And so you see little kids coming to school, and they're just completely grubby. And we went to one school back in 1994, and we just said to the principal, you know, you've got a welder spigot here in the school. Why don't you require that hands and faces be clean before somebody come into the classroom? And so they started doing that. And we did a hand washing activity with kindergartners. And we brought one of the students in our program had finger paint. And so she brought these finger paints and papers for the kids to do these. And they did these cool paintings. They're like 5 and 6 year old, little tiny pumpkins, you know. And then afterwards, passed out soap and, you know, everybody washed. And so this is kind of a fun activity, I mean, getting everybody into the idea. But a lot of farmers have said to me, you know, one of the neatest things about having this, and this, of course, males, for women, it's clearly that they don't have to go to the river with a pole over their shoulder and carry all this water. That's the main thing for the women. It's a labor improvement. For the men, they kind of like getting clean. They've been out working in the fields, and, you know, they can wash their feet. Wash their feet and legs. They wash their faces. You know, they have themselves clean for dinner. So they, you know, this aside from hygiene, it's just a sort of aesthetics of cleanliness is also appealing to people to have. You know, if you don't have any water, especially in the wintertime, well, how are you going to wash? So, yes.
Because of your dependence or use of women to serve as informants and cultural informants and to help with the projects, what is the relationship with men to the projects? Once they're established, do you sense a difference in how men and women relate to the improvements?
Well, to me, it seemed as though the introduction of the project and doing improvement on the projects seemed much more exciting to the women of the village. They were much more excited not having to lug extremely heavy buckets of water and possibly over hours a day back back and forth. And that is a strong incentive for them to want to keep the system maintained so they continue to get water and not have to lug it around. Does that answer your question?
The men,
like Professor Harrell said before, they really enjoyed having the water. They could wash themselves, take a bath, but it wasn't as strong for them, that desire, because they could wash their feet in a river after coming from the fields on their way home. But this way they could do it at home and relax a little bit more. So they really enjoyed it, but it was not as important for them to really get that clean water, get that water close to home.
Also, women are taking care of most of the children. You know, mm-hmm. The children get dirty because everything's made out of mud. And so the women can get the children clean. That's another, I think, another reason why they're excited
about
it. Okay, well, time's up. Thank you.